will live in fear. Three people were killed recently, two belonged to the former Afghan military.
Islamic State attacks rising in Afghanistan. It's Monday, December 13th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Chris Cascale in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Democracy Summit Next Steps. 6 years after Paris Climate Accord. Non-citizens gain voting rights. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Since the Taliban took over Afghanistan in August, attacks by the Islamic State affiliate have stepped up, especially in the country's eastern Nangarhar province. Civilians in the region say they fear the threat of the violence posed by the group known as the Islamic State Khorasan, or ISK. Gaha Pellegrini Batoli reports for VOA from Afghanistan.
IS Khorasan has launched strikes in recent months throughout Afghanistan as the Taliban attempts to consolidate power following their takeover of the country in August. In Nangarhar province, a day does not go by without an attack. Some people are too frightened to speak up, though others want the rest of the world to know what is going on.
Living here is so difficult because of the lack of security. Before we used to have engineers and doctors, now the situation is worse. We live in fear. Three people were killed recently, two belonged to the former Afghan military.
One group no, and four and five group. Daesh, Al-Qaeda, Haqqani, Taliban, government, and all.
This is the scene of a roadside bombing. A Taliban fighter and two civilians were injured. These kinds of attacks are terrorizing the population, says a civilian who witnessed the attack.
There are threats from different networks. This includes risks for civilians. The situation is very dangerous. We cannot leave our homes. There are many different networks killing people.
But the local Taliban commander says the ISK threat in Chaparhar district is non-existent.
ISK doesn't have anyone here. They just want to show the world that they exist. It's possible they may have some people here using their name just to get money, but there aren't any security issues here.
The Taliban, with approximately 70,000 fighters, have been carrying out operations against the ISK militants, who are believed to number between 2 and 3,000 extremists. As the violence continues, civilians are not even sure which factions in the country are responsible for the carnage. All they know is that the attacks are mounting and they are scared. Gaya Pellegrini Batoli for VOA News, Nangarhar, Afghanistan.
Find more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. China's Xi and Russia's Putin dominate G7. U.S., Australia, and Japan to fund undersea cable in the Pacific. COVID-19 disrupts education for more than 400 million in South Asia. Uzbekistan urges other nations to help neighboring Afghanistan. Experts doubt Bangladesh student murder convicts will serve harsh sentences. Find complete coverage on all these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. Thank you for listening to VOA Asia on this Monday. The two-day virtual summit for democracy hosted by U.S. President Joe Biden wrapped up on Friday. The U.S., Australia, Denmark, and Norway announced an export control program to monitor and restrict the spread of technologies used to violate human rights. The U.S. is also launching programs to support independent media and anti-corruption efforts and defend free and fair elections. VOA's chief White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara has more.
From robots patrolling behavior,
loitering is a defense,
facial recognition surveillance to software that turns phones into spying devices. Such technology is often used by governments to target political opponents, activists, journalists, and minority groups.
We focused on the need to empower human rights defenders and make sure technology enables so much of our lives that is used to advance democracies, to lift people up, not to hold them down.
As the two-day virtual summit for democracy hosted by President Joe Biden wrapped up on Friday, the U.S., Australia, Denmark, and Norway announced an export control program to restrict the spread of technologies used to violate human rights. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We've seen the expanded misuse of spyware and other surveillance technology to monitor citizens far beyond what's needed to fight the virus. We've seen the rapid spread of disinformation and misinformation.
The U.S. also announced initiatives to empower human rights defenders, support free and fair elections, independent media, and anti-corruption efforts. Transparency International, a global civil society organization working in the fight against corruption, said the summit's initial outcomes are promising, but more needs to be done. Gary Kalman directs their U.S. office.
Other countries did not step up and commit to specific commitments the way the U.S. has. And so that is a concern. What are they actually going to come up with? They have a little bit more time. The U.S. government's giving them until January to come back with commitments.
Some say the $424 million in U.S. funds for these initiatives, still subject to congressional approval, barely meets the need to bolster democracy globally. Brett Bruin is director of global engagement during the Obama administration and president of the consulting firm Global Situation Room.
These are initiatives and monies that have been allocated already generally for democracy, for the rule of law and human rights. They get to repurpose them for a new announcement. But what we're not seeing here are really substantial sums that are being put on the table.
Democracy is also under attack by the global rise of populism, white supremacy, and extremism, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Polarization is undermining democratic institutions. Science and reason are under siege. All of these is eroding trust between people and democratic leaders and institutions.
An in-person summit is planned a year from now. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Still to come on VOA Asia, assessing where we are in the climate change fight 6 years after the Paris Climate Accord. Happening now in Asia, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is due in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, on Monday. He will also visit Malaysia and Thailand on his first Southeast Asia trip since President Joe Biden took office in January. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Continuing now with VOA Asia, 6 years ago, nearly 200 nations signed the Paris Climate Accord, where they agreed to keep the rise in global temperatures at 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times. Scientists say that threshold is an absolute minimum to avoid catastrophic climate change. For VOA from Paris, Maria Galavan looks at the situation now.
Our fragile planet is hanging by a thread. We are still knocking on the door of climate catastrophe.
As he wound up the recent COP26 in Glasgow, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres had that harsh warning for the 200 countries who had gathered to talk climate change and how to slow it down. Hanging over the summit was the deadline of 2030 for a drastic reduction of greenhouse emissions that was set 6 years ago at COP21 in Paris. Former Executive Secretary of the UN Climate Convention, Christiana Figueres, remembers it as a historic event.
It was a real breakthrough for the United Nations to have a completely unanimous, legally binding pathway for decarbonizing the global economy.
Secretary of State at the time, John Kerry, signed that agreement for the U.S.
It really was an exciting moment when 195, 96 countries come together simultaneously all wanting to move in the same direction, understanding the stakes.
2015 was the hottest year on record. Scientists pointed to that as sure proof that global warming was real and serious. But that record keeps on getting broken as the planet gets hotter year by year. The World Meteorological Organization says the planet has been propelled into uncharted territory with rising sea levels, melting glaciers, and relentless extreme weather events. The WMO warns that extreme weather is the new normal. Nonetheless, both Figueres and Kerry remain optimistic.
We are moving in the right direction. The question is the timing. And I do feel that everyone came out of Glasgow with a renewed sense of timing.
Kerry is now President Biden's special envoy for climate. He was back in Paris this week as part of a whistle-stop tour of Europe to reassure leaders the US is back in the game after former President Donald Trump shut the door on climate issues.
No one country can save this. Everybody has to act.
That was also perhaps the main takeaway from the Glasgow summit, as developing nations pleaded with their rich your neighbours not to be complacent with what has been achieved, but to keep pushing hard to meet that 2030 deadline to save the planet. Maria Gallivan for VOA News, Paris.
Finally on VOA Asia, the New York City Council voted on Thursday to allow non-US citizens to vote in municipal elections. The move will allow some 800,000 city residents in the largest city in the US to have a voice in their local community for the first time. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti has more on the limited expansion of voting rights.
This is New York City, with twice weekly tango classes on a city pier. This is Jacqueline Godoy, who will soon be doing something else you don't expect.
We're going to feel like truly New Yorkers.
Godoy is a non-U.S. citizen who can now vote in New York City's local elections. Much different, she says, than voting in her home country of Venezuela.
It is well known that election over there had been fraudulent. So over here, somehow, you have some guarantees and you can make sure that your vote counts.
Today, we are making history here.
On Thursday, the New York City Council passed a law giving 800,000 more people the right to vote. That includes those with work authorizations, green cards, so-called dreamers who settled in the United States as minors, and other legal non-citizens. New York City is not the first. Several cities in Maryland, Vermont, and California offer some voting rights to non-citizens. But the idea is not expected to expand to state or federal elections.
I think at the federal level, no, given the current Congress. The state level, it's possible. I think there probably would be more resistance.
On the streets of the nation's most populous city, thoughts are mainly positive.
They're in their schools, their universities, they're in their work. So they're actually contributing to our society already. So why not give them a voice to vote?
Whether you was living here 30 days or 30 years, we all should be treated equally.
Finding someone opposed to the measure is not easy in this city of more than 3 million immigrants, but there are some.
Letting them here and giving them the right to at least work here, they should be happy with that.
Meanwhile, Republican New York State Senator Rob Ort wrote that allowing non-citizens to vote is wrong, as it would devalue the votes of citizens and is disrespectful to immigrants who work toward citizenship and the privilege to vote. There's also the work involved in issuing two sets of ballots, an additional one for the new voters limited to local contests, when state and federal offices are also in play.
So I think it's going to be a huge administrative challenge, actually, to the Board of Elections to do this right.
Intro 1867A is hereby adopted.
As the saying goes, it takes two to tango. Godoy says for her first election, she will vote for a candidate the way she chooses a dance partner, someone who connects with her and in whom she trusts. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
That's all the time we have on VOA Asia. Make sure to find us on Facebook, VOA Asia, on Twitter at VOA Asia, and on Instagram, YouTube, and at VOAnews.com. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Jessica Stone. I'm Chris Gascale in Washington. Enjoy the day.